Great. So I'm Mike Gleischer. I'm giving this talk with Lucas Kovar, who is no longer my graduate student. He just finished his PhD. So when you get a chance, congratulate him for finishing his PhD, or offer him a job, or do both. So the topic that we are here to talk about is a little bit different than what was advertised, although we'll try and show you why it's the same thing. What we're going to talk about is creating realistic human motion by using examples. And also, while I understand that Lucas and I are all that stands between you and dinner, the timing is going to be a little different than what's in there. So roughly, I'm going to start out then and talk about some basic stuff. Then Lucas is going to show you all the cool stuff, because he has all the cool demos. But actually, as part of the introduction, I'm going to explain what the outline is. So the topic of the however long this is going to be is how are we going to create realistic movements of humans for interactive applications. And for you, that means games. If you're a federal funding agency, it has to mean something else. The short answer that I'm going to give you, and there are some people tomorrow who will give you a different answer, is we're going to synthesize new motions based on a set of motion-captured examples. So to give you the sort of the 70-second teaser, here is a short video. So what we want to start with is a bunch of motion-captured data. So we get our actor to walk around and we capture him. One of the things is that if we're going to capture him walking around a whole bunch, we can think of this walking as a database of a lot of examples of what it means to walk. Now, don't get the idea that we're going to store this. That's just how we're going to think of our big stream of data. Once we have it in those little pieces, we can think about how are we going to put those pieces together to create longer motions, making him follow along a path, or to get motions that are continuous, that are in between the examples of what we have. Make him take two steps to anywhere on this semicircle. Okay, so a few disclaimers. First of all, I'm going to talk about body motion. For me, this means skeletal motion, sort of the overall growth structure of the body. I am not going to talk about faces, which are at least as hard and probably require a completely different set of techniques. I'm not going to talk about soft tissue or anything about how the body looks or clothing. I'm also not going to talk about hands, which are a really big issue, just sort of watching some recent games. Everything else has gotten better except hands. I'm going to talk about motion capture. Now, there's really nothing in all of the methods that I'm going to talk about that's specific to motion capture. You could get your examples from having an animator keyframe them. I don't have access to that kind of data, so I can't show you that it really works on those kinds of data, but it's worth it. And finally, we are not game developers. We're sort of the token academics. We come from a different place, and I don't mean the Midwest. A lot of the things that you'll see come out of our conversations with people who build games. And one of the things I hope to point out is why some of the things that we've done do or do not work in interactive applications. A lot of times, I think academics have done a bad job of trying to sell their methods to places where they really aren't appropriate. Okay, so that said, back to what we want to do. So we want to create realistic movements of human characters. So first of all, by realism, I don't just mean that it's physics, it's a person walking. When you watch someone walking, you can tell this is me, or if you don't know me, you probably can't identify me by my walk, but you can tell a lot about me by the way I move. You can look at the emotion and all that stuff. So it's very important that the movement of characters conveys all of that. It's also incredibly important that, if this is going to be an interactive system, that everything has to happen fast. Now, that doesn't just mean that it doesn't take lots of computation. It means that it's all responsive and controllable. So when you say, I need this to happen now, you can make it happen now, or at least a reasonable facsimile of now. So given all these things, how are we going to go about doing it? Well, first is human motion is really hard. So we heard today about why appearance is hard, but motion, so people are really, really good at watching other people. I mean, so the psychologists tell me that there's like special purpose wiring on our in our brains just for watching other people. With that, you know, there's all these things. You know, the appearance of how things are is very complex. But what sort of I think sort of creates the real problem is that because people do so many things in so many different ways, the ways that we can tell them apart have to be really, really subtle. The difference between walking when I'm really angry and walking when I'm only a little bit angry aren't very big, but we're able to somehow see them. So these small things matter, but they're very hard to describe. I can't tell you exactly what is it about the way that I move makes it the way that I move rather than the way you move, but I know that it's there. Another thing that we find is that while, say, the generic walking, which is what the animation community might have been interested in 10 years ago, no one's interested in that. You don't just want someone walking. You want, you know, your hero when he's in a good mood and out to get the bad guy. That's what you want. You don't want the sort of the default stuff. So again, we're going to talk about gross body movement, not all this other stuff. That's not to say that all this stuff, other stuff isn't important. But as you found out up until now, lots of people are working on this one. Okay, so if you pick up computer graphics textbook, computer animation textbook, they will tell you there are three main ways to get animation. One is that you can create it by hand. You can have an animator keyframe it or do some kind of manual artistic process. This is absolutely wonderful if you have a great animator. But even if you have a great animator, it is incredibly time and labor intensive. A more practical method, because it's controllable, is to compute it somehow. Either if your computational process is a physical simulation or some kind of ad hoc algorithm, it's all about the same. So this is great because, right, I'm a programmer. I get this. The downside is that it really doesn't work for complicated human motions, because these complicated human motions are far beyond just the physics or far beyond any sort of simple rules. There are all these things that we can't capture. And the way that I like to boil down this versus, say, something with a performer is when you have a real person, a performer, you can direct things. You can tell the actor, you're angry. No, you're even angrier than that. I've never seen a physics simulation that I could do that to. So we're actually going to suggest a fourth method, which we call animation by example. We're going to reuse existing motions. So if you give us some examples of what a good motion is that you got from one of these other ways, we'll figure out how you can use it in new settings. Often this is editing. You give me a piece of motion, I change it a little bit. What we're going to talk about more is how you can change it into to generate something completely new and different. So a few words on motion capture. So a lot of what I'm going to say you probably know, but just I'm going to say it again just to make sure that you're familiar with the words that I'm going to use. So motion capture is great because it uses some kind of fancy sensors to get some observations of what a performer is doing. The nice thing about it is you get the performance that actually happened. That is, if you do this all right. Now, so this is great if what you want is the performance that happened. It's not great if you want to have Superman jumping a tall building because it's hard to get him into the motion capture suit. One of the great things about this, again, is that the actors are directable. So all of those things that actors can do, you can get into your motion, which you may not be able to get other ways. The biggest downside of motion capture, though, is what it provides is recording. It records what actually happened. It doesn't record anything else. So it provides a really reliable and efficient way of recording, but that's all it does. So again, well, this slide is mainly so I can show you silly pictures of a colleague in a silly-looking suit, but most of the, all of the examples I'm going to show you are going to come from optical motion capture. That doesn't really matter. There are other schemes for doing it. One thing I would like to say is, while everyone, when they think of motion capture, thinks of, oh, there's all this fancy hardware to do it, that's in some sense the easy part. The hard part is all the processing that has to happen afterwards. Okay, so if motion capture is so wonderful, why is it not the answer to the problem of getting human motion for interactive systems? So yes, it can replay what happened really, really well, but all it is a recording of what happened. That means you can't control it. So if you want to have a character that you can drive around either somehow, you can't capture everything. If you change what you think you wanted, all of a sudden your data is not what you want anymore. You can't get a continuous long stream of motion. If you want to have a character in an interactive system that's going to be long running, you can't just capture your actor ad infinitum. So because of all this, motion capture is fine for movies, but directly applied, it may not apply so well for things like games and interactive systems. So our answer is to animate by example. We'll use motion capture to give us examples of what we want. We're going to combine these examples to create new motions. We're going to talk about two different ways. One is we're going to sequence these pieces to make longer streams, and then we're going to combine them by using blending to get things in between that we might have missed, and use this to create new motions as we need them. The ones that might seem most obvious is to create this motion in response to what's happening, like in a game engine. However, as you think about these techniques, also think about using them just in the authoring process for however you generate motion now. That you can use these to generate the pieces of motion that ultimately you put together that you will use in runtime, should these kinds of methods not really work in runtime. So the reason that this is hard, and this is a little bit of the philosophy that I'm going to try and get across, is that while human motion is so complicated, ultimately, it's very difficult to characterize mathematically. I can't tell you what it means for a motion to be angry. I can't even tell you what it means for a motion to be walking. So ultimately, the building blocks that we have, the mathematical tools, are going to be really, really simple. So what we have to do is somehow build things out of these very simple tools. So the things that that I would like you to take away from what Lucas and I are going to talk about are, first of all, that there are these very basic building blocks. They're very simple, and because they're simple, there's just no excuse for not doing them right. You can take these basic building blocks and put them together to do interesting things. We can extend these basic building blocks to do some even better things. And one that is an interesting way to think about it that Lucas has really gotten me into thinking about is, as you start to automate some of the processes, it does more than save you time. What Lucas will show you later is that by automating certain things, you'll be able to do things that you never would have thought you'd be able to do. So how are we going to talk about this? So first, I'm going to give you the sort of what I'm doing now, the long-winded the intro. Then I'm going to talk about sort of the basics of working with motion. To give you an idea of the building blocks for building these animation by example methods, my guess is that everything that I'm going to talk about are things that you already know, but by talking about them again, hopefully I can give you some different insights into those things you already know, and also make sure you're familiar with the terminology that we like to use, and some of the intuitions you might not have gotten behind the methods that you use. Some of the constraint-based stuff maybe you haven't seen. Then once I give you the basic building blocks, Lucas will then talk about how he's going to put those together. First, he's going to talk about graph-based approaches, which take those the ability to put motions one after each other to synthesize long streams. These are methods called motion graphs. There's a whole bunch of search-based methods that have been really popular in the animation research community, and something called snap-together motion that we did a couple years ago that's more suited towards interactive systems. Then he's going to talk about parametric approaches. Basically, how do you make blending work better than the basic simple blending? There's a bunch of things here that basically boil down to looking at different motions, seeing how they're the same, and factoring out their differences so they're similar enough that they can be blended. Another piece of this is figure out how much of each motion you need to blend together to get what you need. Finally, Lucas is going to talk about how to actually work with a large database of motion. If you have a lot of motion, how do you find the pieces of motion that you actually need in order that you can put them together to what you want? And he's going to talk about the main trick there is a method called match webs. Okay, so the basics. So my goal here, again, is to review some of the basics of working with human motion and to give you the insight about these basic tools. The preliminaries we're going to talk about, sort of a little bit about kinematics, just a refresher on that. Talk a little bit about signal processing, because these are going to be the basic building blocks that we have. And then we'll talk about constraints. So humans are really complex. You saw the picture of skin. Underneath, people are just as complex. You can try and understand a human at an arbitrarily small level of detail. Clearly, if we're just watching a character at a long distance, we don't care about what each individual cell is doing. So we need some concise way of describing what a person is as some vector of numbers, in which case motion just becomes dealing with vectors of numbers. We want to have a method that's compact. We don't want to have millions of numbers. And we want to try and make the constraints implicit. All of the things that are always going to be true, we don't want to have to worry about maintaining them. I don't want my arm to get disconnected just because I didn't manipulate the numbers correctly. So ultimately, we're looking for some abstraction. How do we get from a person in all the complexity down to something we can actually compute with? One of the things to remember in doing this, clearly, I am throwing something away as I move down this abstraction chain. Does that make a difference? Well, that's a good question. Even some of the things you might take for granted. The human elbow is emphatically not a hinge joint, even though mathematically, for computer animation, we like to think of it that way. Those of us who have done things to our knees understand that our knees are very, very complicated mechanisms with very complicated motions. From as far away as you're sitting, can you see this as anything other than just a hinge joint? I don't know, but... So it really depends on what you're doing, how realistic a model you need. In general, what I see in the computer animation community and also in the interactive systems community is it's better to have a smaller number of degrees of freedom and use them well than it is to have more degrees of freedom. Because as you start to add things like a little bit of a sliding joint in the knee so you can really get that correct knee motion, it's just too hard to make effective use of that. So you're better off just using a hinge joint and using it well. So the standard simplified models of a human is to have a small number of degrees of freedom for the gross motion, roughly treating the human as a bunch of rigid pieces, you can call them bones. Sometimes we'll let those pieces stretch in length a little bit, sometimes not. Usually we'll put kinematic joints between them. That means there'll be a rotation. between the joints. We don't allow sliding. The common term that I hear for this kind of model is a skeletal model. And again, I say this mainly so that when I say skeletal model, we're all thinking of the same thing. So an articulated figure is a set of rigid pieces. So I just want to take a little bit of an aside to talk about how to deal with each one of these rigid pieces. So a rigid body, in the physicist sense, is something that preserves distance as it flies through space. It's a transformation to a set of points that preserves a bunch of properties. It can be broken into two parts, a translation and a rotation. All right, so a rotation. A rotation is a mapping from a point in space to another point in space. One of the things that I found was interesting is, if I actually had to say what was a rotation, I wasn't quite sure. Well, actually, a rotation could be defined mathematically by a very small set of properties. It has a zero, that's the center of rotation. It preserves distance. So if you have two points, after you transform them, they have the same distance. And it preserves handedness. So in 3D, we have the right-hand rule. So a rotation preserves that. One can prove, I couldn't prove it, I had to ask a mathematician to show me how to prove it, that you can prove that this is a linear mapping. So for actually doing something with rotations, we need some way of encoding the set of all these possible transformations into a compact set of numbers that we can compute on. This is called parameterization. Now, because a rotations are this set of things, it's never going to map nicely onto a vector of numbers. In fact, there are some theorems of mathematics that say no matter how hard you try, you will run into problems. So the things that we like from how we represent rotations, we'd like it to be compact. We don't want to have lots and lots of numbers. We'd like it to be complete. We want to be able to represent all possible rotations. We want it to be one-to-one. That is, if you have a rotation, you don't want there to be multiple representations of it. And you want any representation to represent a rotation. This is called stability. So if something is unstable, there's a chance that you can represent something that isn't actually a rotation. You want it to be without singularities. What this means in the mathematics sense is if you have two rotations that are close together, they should be close in their values as well. And you want to be able to compute with them. You need to be able to compose two of them. What happens if you apply one, then the next? You need to be able to interpolate them. What's halfway between? You need to be able to apply them to points. Where does this point go? So in the realm of possibilities, there's a whole bunch. Just out of curiosity, how many people already use quaternions? Okay, good. So I can sort of skip through this part. How many of you know about exponential coordinates? That's actually pretty good. So one of the things I wanted to do was give you some of the intuitions behind quaternions and exponential maps, mainly so I can show you why you don't actually need these. So in the interest of time, because so many people are using quaternions, you clearly understand why you don't want to just store the rotation matrices. We know that you can, because of rotation's linear transform, you know that you can stick it in a matrix. The problem is that it's not nowhere near one-to-one. The set of matrices that are rotations are the special orthogonal group. And if you just give me a matrix, it's very difficult for me to tell you, is it special orthogonal? I don't even exactly remember what special orthogonal comes from. So it's nine numbers. You change one number and everything gets messed up. You can't tell quickly if it is a rotation. So you don't actually want to compute with these. You use whatever you use. You convert to these because this is what the graphics hardware likes. You can't interpolate them. You can't tell how different they are. You can compose them and this is a big deal, although one thing to point out, they do tend to drift. So as you multiply matrices together, the thing that you end up with may not be a rotation matrix at the end. And in 3D, all right, so all these problems get worse. Okay, so in terms of Euler, one of the issues with Euler is he was one of, if not the most prolific mathematicians ever. So Euler has a zillion theorems and a whole bunch of things named after him. So for example, there are two important theorems from Euler that deal with rotations in 3D. One of them gives name to something we refer to as Euler's angles. But that's not necessarily the primary theorem. The primary theorem gives rise to what you would probably call axis angle, where you pick an arbitrary axis and say how much it rotates around that axis. The thing that we use way too often in computer graphics are the things we call Euler angles, where you can pick some set of three fixed axes, almost always aligned with the coordinate system, say the x-axis, the y-axis, and the z-axis. Although you can, the restrictions on which axes you pick for your rotations are remarkably small. So these methods are really popular in animation because they're stable. So if I represent my 3D rotation as a rotation around one axis, a rotation around another axis, a rotation around a third axis, it's easy to measure rotation around an axis. Any set of numbers that I give you is guaranteed to be a rotation. So you don't have to worry about, are these three numbers a rotation? So you can play with these numbers all you want. You can do all the math you want on these three numbers, and you will always have a rotation. The downside is that this stability gives you a false sense of security. You believe that just because you can add them together, that that means something. And push comes to shove, it doesn't. Now, the main reason that people talk about getting rid of Euler angles are singularities. But in practice, the singularity problem for animation with humans isn't that big of a deal. The one that will really bite you should you try to use Euler angles is the stability problem. That there really is no way to do all these mathematical operations. You need something else. The something else for computer graphics these days is quaternions. One thing to note about quaternions, even though they're relatively recent to computer graphics, roughly the past 20 years, they've been around for at least 100 years. Hamilton discovered them, I think it was the 1880s. Just to give you some of the intuitions, I'm going to talk about the case of a 2D rotation. 2D rotations are so easy it's not even worth talking about, but I want to be able to get to the intuition for exponential coordinates. In 2D, a rotation is more or less equivalent to saying, I want to name a point on the circle. If I tell you where this point goes, I can figure everything else out. I know this point has to go to a place on the circle because I'm going to preserve distance. So if I can somehow name the points on the circle, then I have named all the rotations. One little catch, there's that handedness thing that, you know, things can't get flipped around. But let's ignore that for the moment. So how are we going to name the points on the circle? The way that we name points on the line doesn't work well, because the line sort of goes on forever. The circle wraps around itself. So one way that you could name the points on a circle is that you could just sort of give the 2D coordinates. Often, for when we talk about quaternions, it's nice to think about this as the complex plane, so this is the real axis and the imaginary axis. It could be x and y. So the nice thing about these extra coordinates is that every point can be named, every point has a unique name, and close points have similar names. So the Two points are close on the circle. They're close in space. They have similar coordinates. The bad points is it's not stable. I can give you points that are not on the circle. And I can't actually tell you how to do arithmetic that stays on the circle. It's not obvious. So if you take that 2D picture and go on into take 3D, so just as I had the 1D space, I had to go into 4D, into 2D. From 3D, I have to go into 4D. I get quaternions. So quaternions are four-dimensional complex numbers. So the mathematicians say it's a real part and three imaginary parts. But basically, it's a point in four space, as I think of it. And in order for it to be a rotation, it has to stay on the unit, well, four sphere. So really, rotations are represented by unit quaternions. Now, the nice thing about quaternions is that multiplication is defined. So that gives us a way of composing quaternions. And while it's not obvious how to do interpolation, it turns out to not be that hard. There are methods of spherical linear interpolation. There are also methods for doing quaternion splines that are not that complicated. Quaternions are relatively compact, so it's only one extra number. They are free of singularities, and they are nearly one-to-one. For reasons that every time it's explained to me, I forget it, there are actually quaternions map to the half circle or half sphere, not the whole sphere. So there's actually two quaternions for any one angle. Now, the bad points about quaternions is that because you can't add them together, that moves you off of the sphere. All of the things you think of as addition, like taking the average or taking a linear combination, don't work. However, all the things that you really want to do, we have methods for. So if you don't really want to add rotations together, you want to compose rotations. What happens when you have one follow the other? That's actually multiplication or composition. We know how to do that. In terms of averaging, if you have two of them, you can do linear interpolation. If you have more of them, there are some better methods, although I'll show you a trick. There's an issue of telling how far apart two quaternions are, but the method I'm going to show you also deals with that. But an aside here, suppose I do want to average two rotations. One of the things I could do is say, I don't care. These are just points in space. I'm going to do my linear arithmetic with them, average them together, and then reproject them back onto the circle. This reprojection operation, because it's just make sure this vector is unit length, is really simple, really easy to do. In the case of averaging, it actually gives you the exact right answer. For other combinations in between, it doesn't. If you think about it, if I move at a constant velocity this way, what this reprojection method will do is have a varying velocity where it'll start out slowly, speed up, and slow down again. So if you do the right thing, for in this case spherical linear interpolation, you want it to have a constant velocity along the way. The nice thing about this hack method is it extends to things beyond just two things. So the nice thing about the hack is it does work well when differences are small. So later when we talk about trying to combine a whole bunch of quaternions and things are similar, this method does just about as well as the more complicated ways that get you the theoretically right answer. It fails completely when things are completely opposite. So if things are completely 180 degrees apart, you average, you're in the center, you can't project back on because you can't divide by zero. So in practice, this kind of approximation works as well as anything you could ever do with Euler angles, especially when the distances between two angles are small. Now, if the distances are bigger, you should use spherical linear interpolation, certainly. The right methods for averaging things together are worth knowing about, but these methods I believe everything Lucas is going to show you actually implements them this way. So just to summarize, Euler angles are a bad idea for a number of reasons, and quaternions are what we're going to prefer as a way of representation. Just to sort of get at where the exponential map comes from, one way you could think about naming this point on the circle is to say, how far do I need to travel around the circle to get there? This is what an angle is, by the way. A slight tweak on that is you could say, if I start at the origin and I travel for a unit amount of time, how fast do I have to go to get there? Take the velocity. Now, interestingly, velocity is in one dimension because we know what the path is going to be. So we're back to one number as a way of measuring a distance if we always start from the beginning. So what we need to be able to do in order to apply this kind of velocity method is to say, I want a rotation starting here, going that way. Well, really, I have to think about what would happen if I was at the origin, moving at that velocity, that takes me to here, shift this whole picture back as if I started where I really wanted to start. This is a linearization. I've taken the circle. I've figured out what the tangent plane is for the velocity. So I can, you know, because I've linearized the circle, I have all these nice things. It's linear space, so I can add, I can scale or multiply. It's not perfect because there are many ways of getting to the same place. I can travel around the circle once, twice, or any number of times. Well, this is exactly what the exponential map is. The idea is you're going to linearize the space and talk about things in terms of the tangent to that four-dimensional sphere. This gives you, because that's a linear space, it lets you do all the linear operations, which is great. So if you work in that tangent space, you can do filtering, you can do averaging, and all those operations. So the right thing to do is to use quaternions to represent your orientations and use the exponential coordinates to do all the processing on them. In practice, the hack that I showed you works well enough, providing that you use slurp to get between two things when they're far apart. I didn't tell you that, right? No. The good academic in me says, learn about exponential maps. Okay, enough of that sort of detour. Let's go back to humans. Okay, so we're going to have some number of rigid pieces. There are all sorts of different ways of dealing with a set of rigid pieces. Basically, we can think about them as independent, or we can think about them relative to one another. In general, this is what we think of as a skeleton. We're going to represent each piece as relative to the previous piece. This makes it easy to encode some of those constraints, like things stay attached. The translation stays the same. All that changes is the rotation part. So why do we do this? Because I'm assuming everybody does. It gives us a way of enforcing the key constraints. It gives us fewer degrees of freedom because all we have to do is store the angles. And it's easy for doing most of the skinning methods because it gives us nice local coordinate systems. However, we need to have rotations. It means that our coordinates are all coupled. It means if we care about where the ends are, we have to do some math to figure out the angles in the chain. It forces things to be rigid, which we may not want. And it comes up with all sorts of problems about how we're going to define things, how we're going to measure from zero. So that sort of begs the question of, is this the right thing to be doing? Has somebody just given this to us, and do we just accept them blindly? there are people who build systems that are not based on skeletons, that are based on clouds of points. Some of these systems are quite successful. Basically, the argument is clouds of points are easy to deal with because they're just points in space. I can do the math on them. One thing, though, that the assumption is that it's always easy to convert from a cloud of points to skeletons. It's not always easy. Interpolating points, you get weird results because they don't preserve the distance. So if you then go try and go back and reinforce the distance constraints, you can get weird things to happen. So there are a bunch of things that people do to make hierarchies work to get around those problems. However, in the interest of time, this is all sort of how people deal with motion capture data. I'm going to skip that and just sort of say that, well, we're going to just assume right now that we're going to do skeletons. Because we have a skeleton, we have to have one bone that is our root. For that, we have a position and an orientation. For everything else, we have the relative orientations. Because these orientations are going to be encoded by something like quaternions, their rotations, the vector that represents these things really isn't a vector in n dimensions. So we have to be a little bit careful how we do math. And for all the things in this talk, I'm going to assume that we're going to use the same representation. That means we're going to use the same set of bones, the same way of representing each kind of joint. So what does it actually mean to do math if I give you two poses? Well, the first thing is you can't just do math on them because there are angles hidden inside. So just a notation thing, we're going to use this plus sign inside of a circle to mean add the things that you can add and multiply the things that need to be multiplied. So if it's a position, you add those to get composition. If it's a quaternion, you multiply those to get composition. So in this kind of a notation, when I say take alpha times A and 1 minus alpha times B, that's to do a linear interpolation between them, spherically, linearly interpolating the angle parts. If I put a scalar in front of each, a bunch of them, I'm going to do a linear combination. So just a little notation trick. Okay, so does doing math on them mean anything? Well, I told you before we like quaternions because when we do math on them, it generally means something. If I say halfway between two orientations, it really is halfway. However, there are two issues here. One is that it doesn't necessarily mean anything about where the ends of things end up. So if I have two poses, I interpolate the poses. I'm not necessarily interpolating the end effectors. More importantly, though, I'm not interpolating the meanings of the poses. So for example, if I say halfway between standing up and lying down, what is that? Well, it's sort of diagonal, because that's halfway in terms of the angles. So this is sort of one of the fundamental problems of doing computer animation. The mathematics knows nothing about the motion. All it knows is the measurement of the angles. As you do math on them, you're doing math on the angles, not on what you think about the meanings of the motions. So if you want to have the guy getting up, just interpolating won't actually do that. So there's two ways of dealing with this divide, that we have what motion means and what the math is. One is that we can try and develop smarter representations that actually understand what the pose is and what the motion is. This is really hard. Other people are working on it. It's, in general, not the kind of approach that we're going to advocate or we're going to talk about. What we're going to talk about are what we like to think of as data-centric approaches. The actual operations we're going to do are very simple, these mathematical operations that are pretty much blind. We're going to combine these simple operations in ways to get interesting things to happen, but ultimately, where the richness is going to come from is from using lots and lots and lots of data. So that's sort of the philosophy. Okay, so enough about poses. We've represented our characters. We can do math on the poses. Now we can think about motions. A motion is just how that pose or that vector that represents the pose evolves over time. The way we're going to represent a motion generally is as some kind of sampled representation. We know its value at a bunch of different places. You can think about this as a very sparse set of samples that you do some kind of interpolation for, or some dense set of samples saying, know what, where, what the pose is at every single frame. For everything that we're going to talk about, we're going to use these dense representations. If you have the sparse representation, it's easy to get these. So the question is, how do we manipulate sets of samples or motions?
So
while a motion is just a series of poses, the individual poses themselves don't make up the motion. So if you were to change one of the poses, you're probably going to mess things up. Because in the real world, things don't just jump to new locations. They somehow move there. Therefore, we need to have some way of talking about how we're going to change the whole set of poses in a consistent manner. So we need a vocabulary for this mathematics. We need to be able to talk about how things can change and how they can't change. So the mathematical tool that lets us talk about how things change is signal processing. Now, just like before, signal processing is not going to be a cure-all. Signal processing will give us a vocabulary for talking about how things change over time. It's not going to give us a way of attaching mathematical terms to things that have meaning. So just a refresher for those of you who know about it and a bit of terminology for those of you who haven't seen this. A common trick in signal processing is you think of anything that's evolving over time, any signal, as a set of different frequencies. That you can create it by combining things that move slowly and things that move quickly. The low frequencies are the smooth parts. The high frequencies are the things that are the abrupt changes. Whenever you have something that varies over time, a motion, it's going to be made up of some smooth parts and some abrupt changes. So real signals combine a whole bunch of these. So again, low frequencies are the smooth parts. High frequencies are those abrupt changes. So the common example that I like to bring up where this comes into account is removing noise. So the misconception that people have from using motion capture is that, the things are noisy. I know that in the real world, things really don't jitter around too much. So any jittering must be noise. Therefore, that jittering is high frequency. So if I only got rid of those high frequencies, I'd be able to get rid of the noise. However, high frequencies refer to any of the abrupt changes, not just the noise. So if you take your motion and you get rid of the high frequencies, you get rid of any abrupt changes. One of the big intuitions that I want to give to you is getting rid of high frequencies is bad because high frequencies are important. So if you're trying to get rid of noise in motion capture, don't just low-pass filter. This is a whole topic unto itself. The thing that I want to convey, though, is the intuition from this, that I don't want to get things that are low-pass filtered. I want to get things that actually have these distinct high frequencies.
Where's the what?
Because the important intuition is high frequencies are important. In the real world, generally, things move smoothly. If there's something abrupt, it's because it's important. Generally, my hands are moving relatively smoothly. They make abrupt things when I gesture to make a point. If you watch me move, my motion is generally smooth until there's an impact or a collision. So high frequencies always happen when something significant happens. Because of this, our perceptual systems are very tuned to it. You pick up high frequencies. So because high frequencies are important, it's very, very important that we don't mess with them. If your motion starts out having high frequencies, it's something like a chef chopping or someone making an abrupt gesture. If you take out that high frequency, you're going to destroy the motion. Similarly, if there was no high frequency, if something should be smooth, if you stick in a high frequency, it's going to stand out like a sore thumb. So what this means is we have to be very careful as we think about motion methods, because we can't introduce pops, high frequencies, these abrupt changes, because if you get some in there by mistake, it's a real nightmare to get rid of them, because you only want to get rid of the ones that you don't want, and you never know which ones you want and which ones you don't want. So you can't just change one pose. You have to change a bunch of poses together, because if you change one pose, you'll make that abrupt change between that pose and its neighbor. So I'm going to show you two tools that we're going to use that make these changes together. And these are two things that come out of basic signal processing methods. So the first tool we call motion displacement maps. They're also called motion warps. The idea is, if I want to change one pose, well, I can't really change one pose. So I can't do this because that to put in those abrupt things. So what I have to do is sort of gradually transition to where that was and transition away from it. So the way that we'll do this is by thinking of that change as a motion or a signal itself. Rather than just being this one place where I want to make a change, it's the whole time. I know that at this point what the change I want to have is. I know that some point in the future, some point in the past, I don't want any change. So my new signal has to be zero there. I can fit a spline through those three points. That spline is smooth. That means my change is going to be smooth. And so I add this in rather than just changing that one frame. This thing with a bump in it is called a displacement map. So what a displacement map does is it adds in a new motion that was specially constructed to interpolate the things that we wanted. We pick it so that it doesn't stick out. It has no high frequencies. One of the things to notice here is that the motion that I'm adding in has no high frequencies. I'm not saying anything about the result. If there are high frequencies in the beginning, they'll still be there. All I'm changing is the smooth part. So we like to call this band-limited adaptation, with the idea that the changes that we make to motions are going to be band-limited. If there's a high frequency to start with, we're going to leave it there. But we're not going to add any new high frequencies because they would stand out. And we don't trust the changes that we're going to add into motions well enough to have things that stand out. So why does this work, that is, if it does? The intuition is we're not just going to sort of have that change stand out. We're going to sort of transition to it and transition away from it to sort of blend it in so that you can't see it. The mathematics behind this comes from something called superposition, which says if you have something that is low frequency, adding it in doesn't disturb the high frequencies of what you started with. So motion displacement maps won't add any high frequencies because they're all low frequencies. That, of course, doesn't mean they're going to work all the time, because the poses that you get in between might be silly. Okay, so another way we'll make use of superposition. Suppose that we know that we have two motions that are good. We can just sort of add them together, and that wouldn't add any new bad frequencies. So really what happens, we can't add motions, we have to interpolate them. on a per frame basis. So if you notice what I'm doing here, I'm going to take every single pose and average them together on a per frame basis. So this is a per frame operation on corresponding poses. We can believe that that from a signal processing point of view, this is an okay thing to do because it's not going to generate any new frequencies. So does this make sense? Well, in a sense, no. Just because it doesn't generate any new low frequencies doesn't mean it's going to have any meaning. So it really only works if each of those individual poses are okay and the new sequence is okay. Or you do this so quickly that no one notices. So one case where it's going to work is when all of the corresponding poses are similar enough that the blending, that when you average them together, when you interpolate them, it means something. So when you have walking and running, if the poses are all similar, they all match up, then when you blend between each pair, the thing that you end up with is probably going to be okay. If you have motions that are completely different, I have my guy standing up, my guy standing on his head, I try and average these, I'm going to get something weird in the middle. That's not going to work. So if it's not going to work all the time, how do we actually use it? Well, what Lucas is going to talk about are two different ways to make use of this very unreliable thing. One is you can come up with some method for finding out if these things are similar, or you can do something to take two things that aren't very similar and make them more similar. So that's what he's going to talk about. The other way of doing it is to use it over a very short period of time. That is to use it where that blend value varies from, say, 0 to 1, and you make a transition. One of the nice things is if your function for alpha is continuous, and these are continuous, you won't introduce a discontinuity. So transitions are really useful, because we often get small pieces of motion that we need to connect. The thing to know about transitions is they can be really easy or really hard. So one way to think about it is if the end of one motion and the beginning of the next are the same, they fit together easily, the problem of getting between one motion and another motion, if they're different, can be an arbitrary animation problem. Getting from me standing up to lying on the floor is, you know, the same as generating new animation. So the simple methods that work for when things are close, there are a bunch of them that people use. And I thought I would run through them because one of the things I've noticed is that everybody has a different name for what they do, and what they do isn't always, and people use different names for the same things. So one thing that we could do for a transition is just to put one thing right after the other. This works only if the end of one and the beginning of the next are pretty much the same. I call these cut transitions because they're just going to cut from one to the next. This is unlikely to work unless you have actually prepared your motions to make sure it works, or that you don't care that you're going to create a visual discontinuity. One other thing that people do is say, well, they aren't the same, so what I'll do is I'll create a new piece of motion in the middle, and I'll interpolate the end of one and the beginning of the next. Well, of course, that only works if interpolation works, which it doesn't that often of the time, and if you don't care about messing up the timing. So if you have something where you have walking and you want to match the cadence, you put in this sort of slide between the two, and it sticks out. So in general, these methods are a bad idea. Now, one thing that you can do, we call displacement plus cut. I know that I need the end of motion 0 to be the same as the beginning of the next motion. I told you that I can use a displacement map to change the pose, to change one pose and do that gradually. So I can do a displacement map at the end of motion 0 so it becomes the same as motion 1 and the two things can get plugged together. Or I can pick the thing halfway in between that the last pose of M of motion zero, the first pose of motion one, interpolate both motions so they meet in the middle. We call this displacement plus cut. This is different than doing a blend transition. So with a blend transition, what I'll do is I'll make sure that there's some overlapping piece of the motion, and then I'll do a blend between the motions with a varying blend weight. So a big difference here from the previous one is the motions have to overlap, and I'm actually using both motions, some amount of them, in the blend region. So one of the things that you might wonder is there actually a difference in doing this? Practically there is, because when you do overlap, you have to have that piece of the motions that you're going to overlap. So you sort of, things get shrunk a little bit. Also, because this blends the motions in gradually, it can create different kinds of visual artifacts. So to give you some idea of what this is like, I did a little example in Excel of all things. What I'm doing here is transitioning from a sine wave to a constant value. One case, I blended. That's the blue line. The other, I did a displacement map and a cut. So notice when I do a displacement map and a cut, they are continuous, right? They meet in the middle. But all of a sudden, the wiggling stops and the continuousness starts. Whereas when I do a blend, the wiggling sort of fades out and the continuousness sort of fades in. Another question when you do this is how long should those transition times be? In general, there's two things. One is that you want it to be as fast as possible. Get it over with. Because they're generated poses, they might be bad poses. And also, if you're controlling something, you want to be doing that next motion no time like the present. The downside is that if you make those transitions, especially with the blends more gradual, you have more chance to sort of fade in the changes and sort of hide the differences. So it really depends on how similar the motions are to how long a blend needs to be. There's no sort of magic answer. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about signal processing. It's important to know that it gives us these tools that we can blend motions together. We can do displacement maps to change the motions to sort of get to specific poses. It gives us these tools that we're going to use for various things, warps and transitions, and that it only works when the individual poses are similar and the motions are relatively similar. So that's what I needed to tell you to set up for what Lucas is going to talk about. But now I want to talk about one last thing. Which are constraints. So far, all I've talked about are the parameters, the math we do on parameters. That doesn't say anything about where the end effectors go. In general, the end effectors will get close, but what happens if you have exact needs for the end effectors? What happens if you know I want my hand to be on the microphone or my foot to be on the floor? For one frame, this is the inverse kinematics problem. The reason that we care about this for what we're going to talk about is that when we blend poses together, it may not preserve where the end effectors are. So in particular, you'll see this, that it generates these kinds of skating artifacts, that I take two walking motions and I blend them together, and I go from my feet staying put on the floor to my feet sort of sliding along or possibly penetrating into the floor a little bit. If the hands are supposed to reach something, they don't get exactly to their goals, or they drift around a little bit when they get there. This is evident even in short transitions, so it's important to do this. So a little bit about inverse kinematics. It's very easy, given the angles, to figure out where the end effectors are. It's not very easy to figure out what set of angles you need to get the end effectors to that position. There are two general sets of methods. One is that you can solve these equations numerically. The methods for doing this are very, very general. They usually involve some kind of optimization. Because it's an ill-conditioned problem, you can run into various issues. Another thing is that it's very hard to guarantee continuity across multiple solutions. If you get cases where you have small changes to the inputs, you can get large changes to the outputs. And it's right. There's another set of methods that are geometric. They're closed-form solutions for things like two links. These are really fast, they're really simple, but they only exist for very special cases like two links. The other piece of this is we can't just use this to solve the animation problems, because you can't change each frame independently. There are special inverse kinematics problems that will guarantee if your input motion is continuous and your goals are continuous, that your result is continuous, but this is actually a little bit tricky to do. Another thing you can do is you can take one frame, compute a motion displacement map that gets you to that one frame, and use that to sort of transition to and away from that. But that only works if there's only one frame that you want. So there are various versions of constraint solvers to address motion problems in these ways. The one that I want to talk about is to address the footscape problem. That's the specific problem of my feet need to touch the ground when I walk and not slide around. This method really works more generally than that, but I'm going to talk about it as the footscape problem. One thing about footscape is it requires us to know what the constraints are. So I'm going to apply it when I know that the foot has to be in a particular place at a particular time. It's not very difficult to annotate your motions to say, yes, the foot needs to be on the floor right now. It's also not very difficult to write detectors that say, the foot probably has to be on the floor. It's not very difficult to get something that works 95% of the time. To get something that's totally reliable is incredibly difficult, because it's not always obvious just from looking at things whether the foot has to be there or not. So footscape can come from a bunch of places. For what we're concerned with, it does come from these warping and blending operations, so the things we're going to do. The method that we need, we want it to exactly enforce the foot plants, to be unobtrusive, because we don't want to add noticeable artifacts. We want something to be simple and efficient, because we want to be able to use this at runtime. And we only want to look at a small neighborhood of poses around each frame. So our method is special case for human limbs. There's a paper about it. And actually, there's an open source implementation of it. One warning. Some people actually tried to use this open source implementation. They pointed out some issues in it. It's only in how the documentation is written and how the code was organized. There's a new version, but we haven't done any testing on it yet. So in the next few days, I hope to have a better version. This solver was used in everything that Lucas is going to show. Just to give you an idea of sort of how we get the kinds of results you're going to see. What I'm going to show you is a special case just to deal with the lower body. It's going to have to adjust where the root is. It's going to have to adjust the angles of the lower body. One of the things that it does is it will adjust the lengths of the legs by a very small, actually imperceptible amount. But I'll talk about that in a moment. It has all those nice properties. It is designed to be simple and preserve continuity. It also handles the case of an articulated foot, where you have a heel, a ball, and a toe. All right, so the algorithm, let's see, I want it to be done by now. The algorithm works in five steps. I'm just going to race through them. Again, all the details are in the paper. So the first thing is you have to figure out where the feet are supposed to go. You look at where the foot is over the course of the foot plant. You average. That doesn't work so well if you have to make sure that both the heel and the ball of the foot are planted. So if you do that, you figure them out independently, and then you project to make sure they're the right distance apart. Given that, you then can figure out where you want to place the ankle. This is a bit tricky because sometimes you will switch from having one constraint to two constraints. In the case where there's only one constraint, there are lots of possible solutions. So it's important to solve the doubly constrained cases first. That will tell you what to do for the singly constrained cases that are nearby, and you do some blending in between to make sure you don't get a discontinuity. The next thing we need to figure out is where to put the root so that the leg is long enough to reach the ankle. So with one leg, you might get a different solution than if you do two legs. So again, you need to be careful when you get the cases of constraint switching. So again, what we'll need to do is have these windows where when the constraints change, we have to blend over time. One way to think about this is if a constraint all of a sudden says your foot has to be on the floor, you can't teleport your foot there. You have to sort of know that's coming in advance.
I don't know why I didn't show both pictures at once.
Finally then, once we know where that goes, we can just adjust the angles. If you do these computations in the right way, you can guarantee that since there's going to be continuity in the motion of the two endpoints, you'll get continuity in the motion of the leg. One thing to note is that as the leg gets fully straightened out, it can take a large motion to make a little bit of change in the length. When my leg is near full extension, to make a little bit of a change in the length, I have to make a large velocity in the knee. This turns out to be horrendously noticeable. There's no way around this. It's a mechanically singular case. So the solution is the preferred solution that we have is to just let the leg stretch even an imperceptibly small amount. That's enough to get around this problem. And finally, you have to make sure that that on the frames where you didn't make changes, that you blend the changes from nearby frames onto those so that you have continuity. So if you want to know, yes, it does work on arms. So let me just show you some examples. So this is a blended motion. Notice how if you just blend the two motions together, the legs splay apart. So this is sort of, it was a high and a low swipe. We want to get a swipe in between. But we don't want the legs splaying apart. So this is a simple blend of good motion. We get something that wasn't good. We can make it good again. So that's a transition between two motions. If you can sort of see the foot sliding all over the place. So the thing that is not fully automated, that is automated but not automatic, is identifying the foot plants in the original motion. After that, everything is using the methods that Lucas will talk about later. So there's nothing, no tweaking to any of the motions that we're going to show. Let me show you another example.
This is when I was talking about knee popping.
So the original motion does not have that much foot skate in it. If you watch carefully, you can see some. However, if you don't pay attention, if you don't deal with a knee popping problem, you can see those sudden jerks when the knee gets to full extension. It really stands out at half speed. So in order to get rid of those kinds of artifacts, this is that sort of that imperceptibly small change in length. In no case in the upper thing is it more than a quarter of a pixel. So it's like 1%, right? And finally, just a hand example. So later, Lucas will show you the blend that makes this motion. But you can see that because it's blended, the feet don't necessarily stay in place, or the hands, where a little bit of cleanup. That final thing on that last frame, I think, is an artifact with a video editing, right? Okay. So because I was very time compressed and still went 5 minutes over what I was supposed to, I didn't give you any of the details, but hopefully I've given you the intuitions so that you can go and grab what we have and make use of it. All right, so in what I had to say, what I hopefully have done is reviewed some of those basic things about human animation that you've known, and hopefully given you some new intuitions behind the decisions that were made, or at least given you the vocabulary that we like to use so you'll better understand what Lucas is going to say. I've shown you the basic building blocks from signal processing, how we can use blends and transitions, and I've shown you a little bit about constraints, which is going to be important for cleaning up the motions when we make them out of blends and transitions. So the next stop now is to use those basic tools to actually generate new motions from the examples. And for that, Lucas is going to talk after we take a bit of a break. So, thanks.
If there's any questions on that section, take a question. Then we'll take a quick break.
Yeah.
A little behind, and then we'll start a new break. Any questions?
Yeah, we're only about 5 minutes behind, so. Yeah.